May it please the court. My name is Rachel Petty, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Eddie Hill. Mr. Hill's conviction should be reversed for two reasons.
Excuse me, could you tilt that mic in the middle down towards
sorry,
you?
Sorry, I'm not. Stopped.
Even a little closer if you can get it. Good, thank you.
Mr. Hill's conviction should be reversed for two reasons.
The could first, you also speak louder?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. The first is that Mr. Hill was prejudiced by the wrongful conviction of certain car purchase records. The second is that the district court's incorrect procedure for selecting the jury and assigning peremptory challenges prevented Mr. Hill from curing an inadequate voir dire. The wrongful admission of the car purchase records prejudiced Mr. Hill because they essentially turned into evidence of prior bad acts.
Wasn't there a hung jury on the count that involved the car?
There was a hung jury on the count that...
So he wasn't convicted on that count?
He wasn't, but the... But the evidence was still, especially for that reason, the evidence that he was involved with some sort of criminal enterprise, the dealership that allegedly sold him the car, went down for fraud.
If that was so prejudicial, why didn't the jury return a verdict guilty on that count?
Well, I would imagine that the jury didn't feel that there was enough evidence to convict Mr. Hill on that count. But that evidence did suggest to the jury that Mr. Hill was already involved in a criminal enterprise, and then the evidence that the jury presumably found was dispositive in the other count was a tape, and the tape, if you read the transcript, the tape is inconclusive at best if you don't consider that Mr. Hill was already involved in some sort of criminal activity. The evidence of the car records suggested that he was involved in criminal activity and made him that much more likely to be involved in the bank robbery at issue. With regards to the second issue, the district court's Rule 24 procedural error prevented Mr. Hill from curing an inadequate voir dire.
That was an agreed procedure, though, wasn't it?
The defendants did agree to that procedure. However, I argue that that was not an error that the defendants were able to waive.
And why do you? What do you base that on?
Well, not all rights are waivable rights. This procedural error is much like waiving, for example, your right to a unanimous verdict, which is another simple rule. It's Rule 31. Many circuits have held that the right to a unanimous verdict is not a waivable right. I would argue that this right is similar to that. We have procedural protections.
Well, this is a little different than the unanimous verdict, though, isn't it? I mean, this is just a procedure thing where the court uses somewhat different way of selecting a jury, and counsel seem to have gone along with it. And it appears from the record that Judge Kaur uses this all the time.
Well, this court recently held in Mendoza that the Judge Kaur can no longer use that method. It's not up to the sound discretion of the trial court.
Did Mendoza have agreement by both parties? I don't think the defendant agreed to it, did he?
That it's not in the appellate court decision. The court does not make mention of whether or not Mendoza agreed to the decision. It seems impossible, anyway, for the litigants to be able to define the rules of the criminal proceedings.
Well, what difference does it make, though? I mean, why is his procedure, whether, if it's not authorized, he shouldn't use it, why is that disadvantageous to defendants?
Well, the method that the district court used prevented Mr. Hill from curing the problems with the inadequate voir dire. During the voir dire, the court asked a number of general questions, which would ordinarily be appropriate procedure. Seventh Circuit has held and other circuits have held that general questions used to elicit bias are...
Well, if the voir dire was inadequate, the voir dire was inadequate. That may be a separate issue. But if it was adequate... I mean, I don't understand. So you want to argue that voir dire is inadequate. That's fine. What does it add to say not only is it inadequate, but there was no possibility to cure it? What does that add?
Well, if the...
It's a matter of indifference. If we have an inadequate voir dire, it doesn't matter whether it could have been cured but wasn't, or couldn't be cured and wasn't, right? Same thing.
Well, if the voir dire was inadequate and the loss of the procedural rights by under Rule 24 didn't enable Mr. Hill to cure the inadequate voir dire.
But why does it matter whether he couldn't cure it or it wasn't cured, right? Unless he's being blamed for not curing it. I don't understand, right?
It seems that if the voir dire was inadequate, then there's reason to believe, and there is reason to believe, because of the juror Salvador's comments, that the jury that actually sat was not impartial. So then it does matter that he wasn't.
You have to have a new trial. But why does it matter whether the inadequacy was curable or not if it wasn't cured?
I don't.
What incremental harm could be done to the defendant?
Well, it's just the court would review it under a different standard if the problem with the Rule 24 procedure prevented him from curing it. Then we review for plain error as opposed to abuse of discretion.
I don't understand. I don't get that.
I'm sorry, I don't think I understand the court's question.
I mean, suppose the judge said at the beginning of voir dire, or suppose he said to the lawyers, I don't like peremptory challenges. I'm not going to give you any peremptory challenges. And he says, moreover, I'm not going to, at the end of the voir dire, I'm not going to let you say anything more to me or anything like that. So, by depriving them of peremptory challenges, okay, that's a serious error. Now, he said, if I make any errors, they're not going to be curable because I'm not going to listen to you guys anymore. Well, that wouldn't add anything to the violation, right? The violation is not giving him the peremptory challenges. Here, the violation allegedly is inadequate voir dire. The fact there's no curative process at the end is completely irrelevant.
Well, if the
it adds no harm to the defendant.
If the voir dire had been inadequate and the defendant.
Look, either the voir dire was adequate, in which event this curative provision is irrelevant, or it was inadequate and it was not cured, in which event the curative procedure is also irrelevant. He can only be harmed by an inadequate voir dire, not by some curative machinery that isn't used right.
Well, if the jury that ultimately sat, if there's reason to believe that the jury was not impartial, then Mr. Hill was harmed.
But that's the only issue.
Yes, that is the essence of the issue.
But that's, you're trying to impute what that one juror said to the rest of the jury.
Well, that was a juror that obviously held some unpopular views, and he
also wanted to get off the jury.
Whether he wanted to get off the jury or not, he essentially told Judge Kaur that he was uncomfortable professing his views in front of the entire veneer. And at that point, Judge Kaur was on notice that the general questioning had been inadequate, and that for some reason, whatever was.
Well, what was inadequate about the questioning? What should he have asked?
Well, under normal circumstances, the questions asked by Judge Kaur would be fine. This court and other courts have held that general questioning to elicit bias is adequate procedure. But in this case, the judge was on notice that this juror and perhaps other jurors didn't feel comfortable answering those questions honestly.
Suppose you have a nut on the jury. Does that mean, why would that be a reason for asking different questions of the other jurors unless this nut had, you know, said something in the presence of the other jurors to poison them? But if he doesn't, I don't see why.
I don't think there's any information in the record that Juror Salvador was a nut.
Unusual reaction, why would there be an implication that other jurors were thinking the same things?
Well, if one juror is uncomfortable answering honestly in front of the entire veneer, then it's reasonable to assume that other jurors might be similarly uncomfortable.
And in the next trial as well?
Well, no, just in that.
Well, why not?
I'm sorry,
Mike. They have a bunch of people. They're all called. They come in. Half of them become the voir dire for one trial. Half of them the voir dire for the next. Why would the fact that the poisoned, the bad member was called for the first jury make it any less likely that the second jury was tainted or had other people like that? Okay.
Well, in two different situations, the atmosphere is different in this.
But he didn't say anything to the other jurors, so why would that affect the atmosphere?
Well, whatever was constraining him presumably was constraining everybody.
I don't understand. I don't get that.
My time is up. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Petty. Mr. Ferrara?
May it please the Court. On behalf of the United States, my name is Michael Ferrara. The defendant's conviction in this matter should stand. The defendant was not prejudiced in any way by the jury selection process employed by the district court below. The defendant agreed to a jury selection process that led to the selection of a fair and impartial jury, and the defendant was in no way prejudiced by the court's deviation from the standard expressed in Rule 24C.
With regard to that Mendoza case, would you agree with your opponent that there was no indication whether there was an agreement by defense counsel to use that procedure?
Your Honor, in that case, I do not know that the opinion makes clear whether there was agreement or not. Certainly in this case, there was an agreement. The defendant was well aware of the process to be employed, and a complete reading of the record shows that it was presented to the court by agreement. The exchange begins with the Assistant United States Attorney saying, "I've spoken with defense counsel. This is the process that we have agreed to." At the end of him laying
that
process.
That's the process Judge Kerr normally used. I mean, that's why they were doing it.
That is correct, Your Honor.
When did Mendoza come down with relationship to this case?
Your Honor, Mendoza came out in December of 2007. This case was tried before Judge Kerr in February of 2007, so therefore it predates this court's decision in Mendoza. Within Mendoza, this court found that the deviation from Rule 24 was harmless and noted that such a deviation would require reversal only if it affected a substantial trial right. In this case, the best the defendant can argue is that the loss of an alternate specific peremptory challenge affected his right to have his case heard by a fair and impartial jury. The defendant has made no such showing that his case was not heard by a fair and impartial jury, and within the record there is nothing whatsoever that would indicate or that would support that argument at all.
The alternate was never seated in this trial.
That is correct, Your Honor. This case at the trial level was heard by the original 12 jurors. Neither alternate was seated.
And the defendant got additional peremptory strikes.
That is correct, Your Honor. The process employed was to allow the defendant 13 total peremptory strikes to be exercised however he saw fit. And that is an addition of two peremptory strikes over the 10 plus one method prescribed by Rule 24.
You also got extra strikes.
That is correct, Your Honor. But beyond that, the defendant did not even use the 13 strikes that were allotted to him. In the defense's reply brief, they indicate that although there was an agreement on the record to allow the defendant 13 peremptory strikes, that he was in fact only given 12. There's actually nothing in the record to support that proposition. And in fact, the defendant chose to exercise 12. At the end of that exercise, the government struck another juror. At the end of that process, the court sat the original 12, and then using the process that Judge Kerr employs, took the next two names on the randomized judges list, and those two jurors became the alternates. But in this case, the defendant has alleged no prejudice whatsoever for the actual jury selection process used, and instead bases his entire argument based on the adequacy of the voir dire. And although the two have nothing to do with each other, here the voir dire was entirely adequate. The voir dire was conducted by a process that this court has held to be proper, with general questioning followed by individual questioning. Basically, the defendant rests his entire argument on the one juror that the district court went out of its way to indicate was doing everything possible to remove himself from the jury. The fact that he held information back doesn't seem to indicate that it was a product of bad questioning in the voir dire or him being uncomfortable. It was merely a continuation of that juror's attempt to remove himself at all costs. It was just the next statements that came out to take himself off of the jury. The jury that heard this matter was, in fact, fair and impartial, and nothing with respect to that excused juror, who was excused for cause, could be used to show any inadequacy. With respect to the admission of the vehicle purchase records, as the court has already pointed out, those records pertained only to account that the jury did not return a guilty finding. And with respect to counsel's point that this somehow impugned his character, that he would do business with this criminal enterprise, that argument simply does not hold water. The jury heard evidence of two violent bank robberies. They heard a tape on which the defendant admitted his own involvement within these robberies. The fact that the defendant purchased a used car from a company that didn't keep accurate business records and allowed cars to be put in another person's name certainly did not impugn his character to the point where the jury would be swayed by that information. And furthermore, the jury was already on notice that the information regarding that purchase price was not accurate. That was fronted on the direct examination that this company did not necessarily keep accurate records. The jury was presented evidence from other sources, including an eyewitness that saw the defendant driving this car after the robbery and testified that before the robbery he did not drive this car. Therefore, the only thing that these records added was the purchase price of the vehicle, which the testimony came out was may or may not have been accurate in the first place. So, Your Honor, for all of these reasons, the government respectfully requests that the decision below be affirmed.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So, Ms. Petty, your time had expired, but if you have anything further, you could have a minute. Do you have anything? Okay.
With regard to the car purchase records, as the government has stated, on direct examination, they introduced a good deal of evidence that the car dealership was a criminal enterprise. And to introduce that information, as well as Mr. Hill's alleged purchase from that dealership, is just simply evidence of prior bad acts, which is otherwise inadmissible and prejudice Mr. Hill.
Okay, well, thank you. And, Ms. Petty, you were appointed, were you not? So the court thanks you for your efforts on behalf of your client. We thank Mr. Ferrara as well.